Okay, so welcome to those of you here in the room and those of you online. So please just get comfortable in your seat. Adjust the posture until your back feels straight, your shoulders relax, and your hands are in a comfortable position. Then let your body breathe itself. As the body breathes itself, allow yourself to relax into awareness. Imagine that the ground beneath you is made of a starry sapphire light. It's very soft. And the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. With the space directly in front of you, on a throne, which has upon it a lotus and sun and moon seats, is sitting the Buddha Shakyamuni. And he is surrounded by an assembly of enlightened beings. These include other Buddhas, there are bodhisattvas, there are deities, there are protectors, and there are guardians. In this great number of enlightened beings is in the space above you. Meanwhile, you're surrounded by all sentient beings, and these include your parents, your mother beside you on the left, your father beside you on the right, and friends and family are behind you. In front of you are difficult people, people who misunderstand you and whom you misunderstand. Also, many strangers surrounding us. Now just take a moment to recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive. So while we are still alive, we have the leisure and opportunity to attain our own spiritual goals. But we must act quickly though, because things are not quite right. And the world doesn't exist as it seems to. Nevertheless, we do have a spiritual friend who's leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. The Buddha, our teacher or the physician, his teachings, which are the medicine, and his spiritual community, the monks and nuns, like nurses. So to make our offering of practice as pure as possible, imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity. You're holding a vajra and a bell. You're sitting within a sphere of great enjoyment. It's within a sphere of enjoyable bliss that you say, as the leader of all sentient beings, "I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings." But in response to this prayer of ours, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. These dissolve into yourself and all living beings. surrounding you. So negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Our health and lifespan are increased, along with our virtues and realizations. We're cleansed by wisdom and fortified with love. Recollect the four original thoughts. Love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Decide to develop these yourself. And having done so, establish all beings into those four immeasurable states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And again, these dissolve into yourself and all living beings surrounding you. And all of our negative karmas and obstructions are purified. And our health and lifespan, along with virtue and realizations, are increased. And cleansed with wisdom, fortified with love. Exhale, relax. From that relaxed state of awareness, you invite the field for accumulating merit. But which appeared. And before them we say, reverently I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, exhale, and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the meritable holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merit to the great enlightenment. So to prevent ourselves clinging to the merit is truly real, and to stop all samsaric appearances, imagine that your ordinary body, speech, and mind, your merit and enjoyments are utterly transformed through your knowledge of the wisdom of emptiness. And all of this goodness reappears as the enjoyment of a Buddha world. We're going to offer this the pure land to the Buddha in front of us. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirring with flowers, the dawn of Mount Meru, for a conference to ceremony. I imagine this as a Buddha field moment. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Nidam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamriya Tayam. So the Buddha accepts our offering and he smiles at us with delight. And we look up into his eyes and we recollect the three principal aspects of the path. So induced by our recollection, our prayers and wishes, emerges from the Buddha a second figure, moves through space, with the body above the crown of their head, descends and absorbs into you. Whereby your form clearly becomes that of the Guru Buddha. So radiating from the symbol of your heart, light rays fill the 10 directions of space. And place all sentient beings into the state of the Guru Buddha. Within the state, we hear the mantra of the Buddha and we begin to recite it. And so we say, I think that the two purposes have been accomplished. And recollect that all of this has taken place in terms of imagination. And this imagination has imprinted the mind with this possibility of full awakening for the sake of all sentient beings. I think that you wish to continue your studies of the Dhamma to generate renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view, and awaken fully for the benefit of others. This is why we study. And breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open, and move your shoulders, your hands, whichever part of your body you'd like to, feel quite at ease and relaxed. So as you know, this is the review. So we've covered quite a lot of material. We looked at meditation, its types and purposes. We covered the posture, breath, and visualization. We introduced some different obstacles we might face in our meditation, and we looked at how we can remove those. Impermanence, we looked at precious human rebirth, and we looked at how you dedicate your merit. So briefly, what we're going through is something sort of similar, as we've covered the material. So today's topic is just like that, reviewing that material. There's a lot of books you could call upon that would be helpful. I've used these ones here, just to get a very wide covering over this topic called meditation. So in here, we've got Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. So this one book of a series of five. In the very first one, they have a section on how to meditate. And book four talks about a state of meditation called calm abiding, how you develop it and the problems you meet. This next one, in Praise of Great Compassion, the meditations there are primarily on great compassion and bodhicitta. This next book has material on the eight worldly concerns, and also meditation and mental states. The lip book right next to it covers every stage of the path, and also there they have a good section on the preliminary meditations and later on karma abiding. Gradual Awakening is a commentary on the three principal aspects of the path. It's terrific. The Buddhist Path, the Divine Holiness, and the Lord Thupten Jinpa, I think that is the first or second book in a 10-book series. And there again, this beginning part has got a very good section on how to meditate. But most of these books are all based around what they call the Lam Room, Lama Tsongkhapa's Lam Room. Walking Through Walls is a terrific book. It's sort of advanced. Sometimes the language is a little bit scholastic, and it might appear quite dry, but there's a lot of good information in it. And primarily on the different states of mind that take place when you meditate. The Finding Foundation of Buddhist Practice, again, this covers the major topics that we've been going through in our classes. So start off here looking at the motivations for meditating. There are a number of different motivations. So many people come to Dharma centers like this or meditate at home to benefit this life. They're either stressed out, they want to calm down, they've got to do something. And so they do. From a Buddhist perspective, this is seen as not Dharma, but nevertheless, it can still help you. Once you start practicing for the future, then it becomes Dharma. What type of future might you be aiming for? One that still involves the problems of this world. That's okay. But most of us prefer to be free from all the problems, and we seek our own personal liberation. And that state is called nirvana. But even greater than that personal freedom is to become fully awakened for the benefit of others. In other words, you're going to help them free themselves too. So you can see the motivations range from sort of self-benefit to helping all beings here. So basically your reason for practicing, your reasoning for meditating determines its power and where it will lead you. There's like two purposes for meditating. One is, of course, for yourself. The other purpose is for others. It's like, I guess, like learning to swim and then becoming a coach, right? You're going to have a swim practice and save your own life. You'd like to help others save theirs, so you do a little bit more. So when we meditate, there's a couple of things. We're trying to remove what they call the two obscurations. So these two obscurations are what they call afflictive obscurations and the knowledge obscurations. The afflictive obscurations are basically mental states like hate, lust, any sort of mental state that disturbs the mind and creates problems for us. We want to remove that afflictive obscuration. The other type of obscuration is called a cognitive obscuration, and that has arisen through the misidentification of phenomena to be inherently existent and believing. So we have phenomena appear to truly exist. We've believed it, although they're not. And so that has imprinted the mind with this obscuration. It's called a cognitive obscuration. Cognitive obscurations prevent you from becoming a Buddha, but they also prevent you knowing the mind of the other. And that's, you know, if you really want to help someone, you need to know, we need to know about them, their disposition. This can only happen by removing those cognitive obscurations. What we want to generate in this removal is compassion and wisdom, often called method and wisdom, that's it basically. Yeah. And so we start by developing these singly, one at a time usually, but then we sort of integrate them. And why is to support the development of the mind of enlightenment? As you know, compassion is not the mind of enlightenment, nor is wisdom that understands emptiness. We've got to integrate these two and have a wish to become fully awakened for the benefit of others. By doing so, we can achieve Buddhahood. Now, the purpose of this, basically, what you're doing is you're sort of purifying the mind and then creating all the good qualities. So when we come to meditate, the posture is very important. And the way it's described is often in 7 or 8 stages. It depends. So here we have a picture of Shakyamuni Buddha in his sitting in meditative equipoise with his hands in that meditative posture. And so here we have, it's important that he's sitting here like this, his eyes are straight ahead, but the eyes are not like that. They're not looking straight ahead, looking down. And they're not wide open, they sort of become closed. You want to try and get your nose and your navel aligned. Can you sit? The breathing should be effortless and natural. So this is just primarily for lam rim meditation. But there are other postures, and you can do different things for different types of meditation. But to keep your lips and teeth natural. The tongue should keep behind the upper teeth. And that's not easy to do that. It's a little bit strange. Put your tongue there. But it has a good benefit of, like, once you start to meditate well, if you don't have it there, you'll start to drool. So that stops it. So did you want to see Rupa Shane on Saturday, was it, or Sunday? If you touch yourself, you have a teeth. So you sit there, of course, he's drooling, you know. So then he apologized to us, the audience. I've had the stroke and the whole left side is like this. I just apologized to him for this. But I go, wow. Stop the drooling. But I keep our shoulders straight and even, of course. And this is the most important part, the spine being straight. Cross legs, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. I think that's it. When you look at these lists, sometimes the lists won't be the same as this. It's often called the 7-point Barotrauma posture, but then so they always add an extra one at the end. Not always, but sometimes they'll have an extra one there. And that has to do with the breath itself. If you come across lists that are different, okay. Now, this posture is best because it's conducive to developing pliancy. So pliancy means that the mind is supple, it's not as rigid as ours is at present. And there's two types of pliancy, there's mental pliancy and physical pliancy. And what these two types of pliancy do is they bring pleasure to the mind and body. So that you don't get tired when you meditate, and the body doesn't hurt. You go for a long time like this, and so you don't get exhausted. So there are many different ways of sitting and meditating, but they say like this is uncommon because it's particularly for the Buddhists. This 7-point Barotrauma posture, and for those who know about the posture and what it means, they become inspired. You know, just say, hey, this is what these Buddhists are meditating upon. And I said, it's used by the Buddhists. So this knowledge of the posture is to transform. The knowledge transforms your posture from a physical chore into a meaningful act. Connects your personal effort to a vast tradition of awakening. Even if you use a chair, his aim for the same dignified, stable alignment. And as I said before, the most essential point is to keep your spine straight but not stiff. We haven't covered a great deal here, but it might be something that's interesting or something you'd like to ask or add, is there anything? Yep, so we've only just covered a very little at the moment, so you might not have questions, but if you do, of course, speak up. Okay, so basically, we've just gone through the motivations for meditation, you know, knowing what your purpose is for meditating and what the goals are of the meditation. We know about the 7-point posture and that there are a lot of benefits of sitting correctly. So, let's do our first meditation. Just get comfortable in your seat. The true Dharma motivation for a meditator goes beyond temporary comfort. A Dharma practitioner meditating aims to remove the causes of suffering. This makes each moment on the cushion a step toward lasting qualities for ourselves and others. The rare chance to meditate is like a blind turtle surfacing in a vast ocean and placing its head through a golden yoke. So when you meditate, how does clarifying your motivation change the practice? It gives your practice a purpose. It turns the effort you're making in your meditations meaningful. And when you find yourself in some sort of difficulty, what motivation feels most supportive to you when you come to meditate? So whether seeking your own peace or the peace of all beings, connecting to that aim gives your meditation strength. This is a bit like the turtle that was sort of holding on to that life-saving yoke. But why is the motivation beyond our own single peace more powerful? Why is the motivation that is beyond seeking our own state of peace more powerful? Our motivation is aimed beyond our own welfare. It's more powerful because it joins this very small effort we're making with vast compassion. The compassion of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and the sentient beings who came before us. Again, just for a moment or two, just return to your original intention for coming to these classes and just rest in that intention for a moment or two. This is the heart of your path. And then just breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. Okay. So here we have a quote from the Dalai Lama where he says, all Buddhist traditions share two forms of meditation. Serenity, which is principally stabilizing meditation, and insight, which is principally analytical meditation. Which leads us in these different types of meditation. So this is what the section is on at the moment. So there are types of meditation, and the one just mentioned was stabilizing and analytical. But there are many others. These are the major ones. So objective and subjective are meditation, review type meditations. So there would be three principal aspects of the path or foundation of all good qualities. That's the review meditation. Prayer type or wishing type things. This is like when we make four immeasurables is a wishing type thing, prayer. Imaginative ones, this is not really here, we're talking about more about the practices we can do before having a direct insight into emptiness. So we try to imagine emptiness through our reasoning and the appearance of deity, and it's all just on the imaginative level. There are pujas, these are gatherings where we all come together and make offerings. And then there are the sadhanas that we have to do our tantric practices. But there's also dance, is also a form of meditation. It's not one that we do. But however, in Australia, particularly in Brisbane, I know, and Melbourne, there are a lot of Westerners who dance over a mandala. That our mankind normally taught them. So that's also done here. But again, we come to stabilizing meditation or displacement meditation. What is it? But what we're trying to just develop a stable mind that can stay on it, the object that we choose, and it won't be interrupted. The stabilizing meditation is often called karma binding, but it's not doesn't necessarily have to be karma binding, right? It's just being able to concentrate the mind, have it calm, and just place it where you wish to place it. And what you often place it on is an object that you've been analyzing. So this stabilizing meditation, what you often do is you sort of stabilize the mind first, just get it calm. Then you do analysis of some sort. And when you get the correct analysis and stabilize again, you stop analyzing to put pressure mind on it. Like I said, so there are many different types of objects you can stabilize the mind upon. One of the ones that Baba Tsongkhapa suggested was an image of the Buddha. But like I said, you can use basically anything. Beginners most often use the breath, of course. So, as you all know, meditating on the Buddha is not an easy thing to do, is it? Not at all. So there's got to be a good reason for it. So here Tsongkhapa says that by meditating on the Buddha, so here remember, we're really saying becoming familiar with Buddha. So we really recollect the qualities of Buddha. So can we recollect what the qualities are in terms of method and wisdom? That might be easy to say like that. So what qualities in terms of the method does the Buddha have?
Skillful means.
Yep, skillful means, yes. That's what method is, right? So what's the major skillful means?
He knows how to teach to individual people.
Yes, he does. Yes, it's bodhicitta, right?
A bodhicitta.
So this is especially the Mahayana. It's that, and then of course on the wisdom side, it's the wisdom realizing emptiness. But there's many different ways of recollecting the qualities if you go through the text. So this is the primary idea: is to look at what does this word Buddha mean, and what are the qualities that a Buddha possesses. So this helps a great deal at the time of death because the Buddha is a virtuous object. So of course, if you die trying to visualize the Buddha or hold it in mind, you're dying with a virtuous mind. If you've taken refuge, then the refuge will deepen. Because the object is so virtuous and meritorious, and just placing your mind on it, bringing attention back to it, creates merit for yourself. It enlivens the other practices. So, so how this works is when we meditate on Buddha, like we take refuge and so forth. Then we bring the Buddha in and we absorb. The absorption takes place. So, often what you do is you wait there for a while, right? Just absorb in the non appearance of inherent existence. Just rest the mind there. And then what will probably happen pretty quickly is you might feel a thought come. Well, as soon as it does, now you start analysing on any of your land limb topics. So you just, whatever the topic is that you want to become familiar with, that's what you do now. And it's a fantastic preparation for Tantra. Now, I should tell you too, when we meditate on the Buddha, most of the sutra path, it's important, of course, to try to visualize the Buddha as clearly as possible. But if you were to ask, which is more important, to see the Buddha really clearly or to feel the presence of the Buddha? The answer would be the presence. Thing is like to feel like you are a Buddha, or that the Buddha is here, he's coming to you, you've utterly transformed yourself. That's the more important thing, rather than getting a clear up image of it. The clear image is really important in Tantra, but not so much here. Like I said, the more thing is to actually feel like Buddha's in the room with you. Even though you might not be able to see him like this, and you can't, of course, you're trying to see him with your mental eye. So then we come to analytical meditation. We ask what it is. Simply put, this is what it is. It's the use of focused inquiry to understand reality.
It's an amazing image.
so to discover what reality is, we start with something that exists, a conventional truth object. We take that conventional truth object and we analyze it to see whether it has any has an intrinsic nature, obviously, that it does not. And as I said, a perfect seeing is not seeing. So what are we not seeing? Inherent existence. We're not seeing that. That's perfect. And that's fine. But why? Why don't we see it?
Because it doesn't exist.
They do, that's right. Because it doesn't exist. That's right. It only looks like it's there, and it's not. Yeah, so analysis is a major goal of analysis is to discover this, the absence of intrinsic nature. However, we can also use it to understand our impermanence, the mind of enlightenment, all the topics. In fact, nearly all the lab room is analytical. And the benefits are, of course, a deep, transformative understanding. Now, like I said, when we use the analysis, we begin simply by analysing ourselves as persons. We see that we as persons have no intrinsic nature, and that's great. However, we need to go further than that. So we actually need to start meditating upon the empty nature of the mind. So we move from person and then we go to phenomena. And then we've got to bring these two things together. Yeah, so as we train like an hour, age of learning for us, it's one thing at a time. We often sort of do a lot of analysis this way, and but we placed it here just on the breath of the Buddha with no analysis. But then over time, we're going to sort of bring them together. And they do, the analysis disrupts the placement. I think you've got something really stable, and then you put something else on it, and then you're going to start thinking, well, it's going to disturb this. But then it sort of comes together again, and now it settles down, and they just place again. So the stability of the mind is to support wisdom. So all the practices in the land room are to support an understanding or realization of emptiness. And this is how it sort of works. So if you imagine, like as beginners, we started off, we're sitting here, we're surrounded by all sentient beings, we've placed the Buddha up in front of us, we've taken refuge, the four immeasurables, seven limbs, we've offered the mandala. The Buddha has come into us, and we're sitting here like we feel as if we are fully awakened. And now we just want to refresh what we know. So we take one of our topics from the land room, and we do this meditation room, we do this analysis to produce an insight into something, perhaps the nature of reality, or a particular feeling that goes with that analysis. And then just rest the mind within that state. But if we were to do this, but not meditate on emptiness, if we were to do it on compassion, we begin by analyzing the suffering of others until we feel a genuine sense of care. So remember, you should have already done this, depending on where you are in the stages, if you do renunciation, you do it on yourself. If it's compassion, then you do for the others. Because remember, renunciation is compassion. It's just directed at you. Then when you come to the other compassion, it's for others. So you have a look at the suffering, and so you actually feel like this genuine sense of care for them. So compassion only exists in reliance upon suffering, doesn't it? If there was no suffering, why would you have compassion? The suffering is sort of necessary in a way to have the compassion. So when you see somebody else or a group of people or some, like I said, suffering, so what happens to you? Something has to happen to you to have compassion for them, doesn't it? What's the thing that happens?
Empathy, that you
want to
help them.
Yeah, you want to help them. That's the thing. It's not just feeling it.
Yeah.
It's like you want to stop it.
Yeah.
You want to stop their suffering. That's That's the thing. That's the thing, right? You have to have that. So when you get that, you no more analysis. Just rest and they're like, I want to help. Like, what's that feel like?
Urgent.
Yeah, that's right. So it's an urgency about it, isn't there? And so that's what you sort of got to feel. And this is the same, very similar type of thing you should have felt to yourself before. You know, you got a sense of urgency about how you lack control. I mean, there's so much going on here and you've got no control over it and you want it to stop. That's the same idea. Yeah, so it's from, yeah, that's exactly right, Sandy. And so, but and it says, from your side, you can see, but I can see the consequences. And I have to stop you for your sake, not for mine, for your sake. So we've looked at stabilizing meditation. We sort of cultivate a single point of focus in this rest of the mind. It is analytical meditation where you sort of investigate the phenomena deeply and try to create some sort of deep understanding or feeling about it. We try to integrate these two. And we can use the Buddha image for stabilization. Okay, let's do the next meditation then. So again, just adjust yourself so your posture is correct, your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed. So let your awareness settle on the natural rhythm of your breath. And set an altruistic intention. To cultivate a mind that is calm and clear and is beneficial for others. Now, stabilizing meditation creates a steady mind. The mind becomes steady through stabilizing. Analytical meditation uses that steadiness to investigate reality. And together, they avoid dullness and agitation, creating a balanced, effective mind. Now, just as the scientist needs a steady hand to hold the sample and a microscope to see its detail. Stabilizing is the steady hand. Analysis is the microscope. So how can you alternate between these practices on a single theme? You use analysis to understand the theme, then you use stabilization to rest in the feeling. So, for instance, if you're meditating on compassion, you use analysis to understand compassion. Then you use stabilization to rest in the feeling. Now, how does visualizing a virtuous image like the Buddha support this? So visualizing on a virtuous image like the Buddha gives you a clear and uplifting focus. Why is analytical clarity needed before resting? Because without seeing the truth through analysis, resting just becomes a state of calm. We should understand that stabilizing and analysis, when they're balanced together, they develop a mind that's both peaceful and deeply wise. Again, just breathing in now, exhaling through your mouth. Okay, so now the next section has to do with these different obstacles that we might meet in our meditations. So here, probably quite as you can see, it's like a table and there's a lot of information on it. So what's on this table basically is the like the five stages and the eight faults when you try to stabilize the mind on an object. So the first four, faith, aspiration, exertion, and mental pliancy, are sort of faith, aspiration, exertion, mental pliancy, these are the antidotes or remedies to the problem of laziness or not starting a meditation. Now, once you've started the meditation, what the next problem will be is that you forget what to do. Or, in other words, you forget your instructions, you forget your analysis. So that's why it's quite important over time to sort of memorize what you're going to do, because you can't like sit here like this and like read the stuff like this. Go backwards and forwards like that to a book, it's not going to work. You sort of got to know what to do. We've got to overcome this forgetfulness. And of course, then there's other problems that arise once we're in meditation. These are excitement and laxity. So to overcome forgetfulness, we apply mindfulness. There we need to sort of check against excitement and laxity, so that requires vigilance. So I think we were here one night and we talked about, so mindfulness is like, when you're driving a car, mindfulness is like your hands stay on the driving wheel, right? That's mindfulness. Your eyes that look up there in the rear mirror and know everything that's going on, that's vigilance. How am I driving? What's going on? That's the vigilant part. Then, of course, we've got to apply antidotes. If we don't apply them, then we've got another problem. And, of course, if we over-apply them and everything's going well, that's another problem. So you just sort of got to learn this way. Now, when we go to meditate, probably for most of us, one of the things that we're going to have is an expectation. And they're not going to be met for a long time, right? And so when they're not, of course, you might get a little disappointed, but this is not a, don't be. To stop the mind that expects good results, the antidote is to relax. So you've got to come back to your breath, relax yourself in the body and mind, and just accept whatever happens. The most important thing, I think, about meditation is just to continue. It really doesn't matter. You're going to have good days and bad days. It doesn't matter. You just keep going, keep going, keep going. So consistency is more important than having a really good meditation. You'd be better off just to get used to keeping on doing it again and again and again. And that one would be better incrementally. Yeah, so accept that it's going to be all over the place. But as long as you keep trying, and like I said, the most important thing is your reason for doing it. Just keep coming back to this motivation. The rest will follow it. And of course, be kind to yourself. That's why loving kindness is there. Just try to be kind to yourself. And have compassion for yourself. It's not easy meditating. So these are four ways we can, four things to oppose unrealistic expectations about meditation. Now, this one is one that's I'm very familiar with, this next problem. It's called sleepiness. Thank goodness it's quite an easy problem that you can overcome. That's the great thing about it. Probably the very best thing is to sleep. Make sure you have enough sleep. I'm glad I put that first. That's the answer. Have a good sleep. Exercise is another good thing. It's amazing how tired you can become because you don't exercise and how, you know, because you walk and do stuff, you seem to have more energy. Always when we're sitting, like, check your posture. Yeah, this sort of thing. Is that just something? Just check your seat, you know, just to feel comfortable and at ease again, and you just start again. Another antidote they give you is to imagine a sphere of light that sort of comes up from anywhere in the chest, not from your heart, but it's dark into the mind. And you know, so it's a bit like some eyes are dark, now there's the light. So you try to imagine this light just, you know, fills up the mind. So we're not sleepy, then we're often excited. So now there's our next problem. So here, instead of having the white come up, you imagine a very dark black drop at the navel, and you bring your mind, and you focus on that, and that brings the mind down. So it might be also interesting for you to try something, check things out. Like, for instance, is like when you close your eyes and you meditate, ask yourself, like, where are your eyes actually pointing? Are they, you know, they're closed, but are they looking straight ahead? Are they looking up? Are they looking to one of the sides? Are they looking down? So if you do that, just wait a little bit, you actually find out, wow, whatever place you place your eyes produces an effect on your body. So just like check that. So one of the things, you know, like we do, we need to think, yeah, when people think they go like this, they look up, and that's what you should do when it comes to the analysis, you know, think. But if you're really excited, then don't look up, look down. inhalation and exhalation, of course, is one of the most common ways of bringing down excitement in the mind. It's just come to the breath because it's neutral. And just check, how am I breathing? You want to breathe naturally. When you're excited, you often breathe a bit faster. And you might find your shoulders creep up a bit. So if you check your body and slow down the breathing, that'll help. Of course, so these are what we call downer ideas, thinking about death, right? So then, of course, you're not excited anymore, are you? And again, it's just, you know, these bad, you know, not bad ideas, but topics that sort of pull the mind downwards, like the lower realms, suffering. You don't feel great when you start thinking about that, right? Or excited, and that's the point. To move to that. Once the mind is brought down, you drop the subject again, you come back to your original subject. Otherwise, you just stop what you're doing and take a rest. I don't know if you've ever had that thing where you just try and try and see you're impossible. Perhaps something that's going on in the family, or you just, the anxiety is so much inside you, you cannot do it. Then, like I said, get up. If I were here, I'd start walking around the alter up the back there, you know? Or you start doing prostrations or something. You know, just slow down. So we say investigate the character. So investigate the character of the distraction. Mindfulness is probably the number one thing. Is just remember what to do. What do you do when you're distracted? What should you do? Well, you should bring your mind back to your original object. Or you can remember any of the antidotes that come with distraction, use them. Again, you need to check the mind itself. Be vigilant. Of course, breath work is really helpful here. But all the things that have to do with excitement, you can really chill right out just by slowing down the breath. We're still getting it natural, then slowing it down more and more. Again, recollect death is one of the major ones to stop you becoming stuck. Restlessness is another type of phenomenon that's very much like these others. The way to stop that is to have less desire or fewer desires. Mindfulness, probably vigilance again, yes. And breath work. You see that these types of mind, especially the excitable types of mind, nearly always just comes back to the breath, just come back to a neutral object, neutralize it, calm down, and then go back to your object. Now, there's a couple of other things that can also happen. Some people get very bad about what they're doing or when they have meditations. Lots of regrets come up. Again, it's breath work. Here's a real goodie, frustrations. But so, so when you feel guilty or really, regretful about some of the phenomena that might have taken place in the past, what's your posture like then?
Slumped.
What I'm often found is that you don't do much when you feel guilty about things. You don't run around and move around about or regret things. Often you sit quite still and you're thinking about it. Right? So meditation is we are quite still, aren't we? Right? And these things come up. And perhaps it's, like guilt is the frustrations that really help to get the energy moving, just shocks these two things. The other thing is pay attention to what your mind is doing. Things go on. To recollect impermanence, that these things will, you can't stay guilty the rest of your life, right? It has to change. And it will. And so does regret. No matter, if you think of some difficult period you had in your life and the feelings and the thoughts that you had then, suppose this happened like a year ago, or 2 years ago. Have we felt that way all the way since we left here without a break? You go, no, that's because of impermanence. So even when it really does feel bad, remind yourself this will change. It only seems to say the same because my mind is clinging to it. Yeah. Training kindness to oneself and to others. Compassion for opponents. So when we have regrets and guilt, then use it in the four opponents. It's like saying that it's time to do the four opponents, come do this practice now. That's great. I feel so bad. Good. Now I can use it. So I've put them into these two different colours here because the white section is more to do with everything beneath the mind of enlightenment. Right? It's just that the what we call practice of the lower and middle scope. Going up higher, it's Mahayana. Yeah, so do be kind to yourself, have compassion for yourself, and use the practice of the four opponent powers. So again, we've gone through, I'm just going to work us through all the different questions that are in the review. So here we started looking at, we started with expectations and looking at the antidotes to those. Then we looked at our sleepiness and delusions and excitement. So this whole section was just the different problems we might meet when we meditate and that there are solutions for all of them. Okay, meditate time again. Again, just again, just adjust your posture, drop your shoulders. Yeah. So here we want to set altruistic intention to shift from struggling with obstacles to working with them wisely. So we want this work that we need to be of benefit for ourselves, of course, but also for others. So there are specific antidotes that we can use for the different mental challenges we meet. And this path that we're creating, the path to enlightenment we're creating, we're not forcing perfection. We're just trying to use the right tool for each obstacle. This will turn the difficulties we face into chances to sort of grow our wisdom and our resilience. You know, so if you've ever gardened at all, been a gardener, well, I hope you didn't get angry at the weeds. You simply grabbed the right tool and pulled them out. So how can you choose, how do you come to choose the right tool for regret? You choose the right tool for regret by recollecting its nature, which is that it is impermanent and empty. Now, regret ties us to the past. So the tool is basically just honest acknowledgement of what we've done that has brought about the regret, and then you let go. So why might an uplifting thought be better than using force when facing sleepiness? Using the gardening analogy, force harms the soil of the mind. Or an uplifting thought is like sunlight that wakes it up naturally. So what's the basic mentality that makes all the tools work? So patient intention to cultivate the mind and the simple satisfaction in your effort. So if you meet your own obstacles with the right tool, every effort you make will become a step forward. So try to identify the obstacles correctly, and then find the correct tool to work against that obstacle. And breathing in, exhale. Now we come to the last section of our class, I think. It's a very big class, isn't it? We come to this topic of impermanence. And there's a reason establishing impermanence, and I've tried to set it up like this. So when you do these things, you set up a subject, and what they call the predicate and the reason. So here you say, take a product. It's our subject product. The predicate is that it is characterized by disintegration from the first moment of its existence because it arose from its own causes with the essential nature of disintegration without relying on some alternate cause of disintegration. The phenomena don't, it's not like, you know, often we talk, we go from one moment to the next. Subtle disintegration is disintegrated before the next moment arises. Disintegration takes place in that first moment.
The disintegration of its existence.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. The moment an entity comes into existence, its disintegration is already present. That's what I'm sort of saying. Right? It certainly doesn't look like it. I would, you and I look at each other like that. We do not look like we're disintegrating. From the moment itself is disintegrating. See, the disintegration of that moment, the second moment is produced. And the third, the fourth, and so forth. Yeah, subtle impermanence supports the emptiness. It's not emptiness, but you know, you can see it, can't you? If you take it like that, the phenomena are disintegrating in the very, in the, there's, it's not the second one, it's the first.
So nothing exists.
No, no. Sorry? Nothing exists, what?
From then to then, it's like,
it does.
Yeah.
What was that? It does, but it's disintegrating.
Yeah.
Like flash
the yeah. Light. It's not like nothing because there's.
And then it's over, and then another
dint,
and then it's over.
Over. Yeah, and the dint produces the next. That's the thing. It's the weird thing. Yeah. So if, like they say, if you get some, just like you see this, and some idea. Oh, wow, if things are like that, is explained subtle and permanent, yeah, then you go, of course, then they're empty. There isn't an actual object there, is there? It's just the moments, but they're passing so quickly. Yeah, we don't even see it, do we? And so then we get solid objects that we know at the same time they're not, because they're disintegrating.
And that happens at different speeds for different things.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, the bookshelf there will disintegrate a lot slower than this computer. Or an apple. An apple that you put out.
Yes.
It'll disintegrate an apple.
Yes.
But then put out in the sun.
Yeah.
So each organ in your body does not all disintegrate at the same time, does it? I mean, like if one goes out, they don't all go out.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, like this one here, subtle impermanence, like you can really see how this really comes into very, very close to emptiness, the phenomenon. It shows why, it's another supporting reason showing why phenomena are empty of an intrinsic nature.
It's very sci-fi.
Yeah, no, it's tremendously sci-fi. That's right. Bitter. It sure is. Yeah, yeah. Well, the meaning of subtle impermanence, this is one I like. So it means momentariness arising in the first moment and disintegrating in just that moment. And lastly, not remaining from the time of the first moment to the second moment. No, that's right. I could kind of realize that. You know, then you think of the phenomena, it's not like they're there now and they're disintegrating. I mean, that's the illusion, isn't it?
Yeah.
It looks like that, but it's not like that again. Yeah, yeah, that's right. The very subtle level is quite obvious, but this level is definitely not.
Yeah,
yeah, we're at the gross level.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everything is solid and real and big and thick. And we talk about cause the conditions of it, it's a little subtler, isn't it? But they're words. It's like you never see a cause or a condition in the world. They're just descriptors. One of the things that in these questions is like, so what does impermanence oppose? How can you use impermanence to oppose disturbing emotions? Well, you know that each one of them has no solidity whatsoever. Nothing said. As they're coming in, they're going out, aren't they? So our thoughts are just like it said there too, right? Not remaining from one moment to the next. Not remaining from the time of the first moment of a thought to the second moment. The thoughts are the same. In fact, like you can't even, I mean, like you go like this, you at least put your hand on the clock, eh? And now, yeah, I know the clock's in something to work, but I can hold that. It's some sort of form. But you can't even do that with the mind. mind doesn't have that. But because the mind changes, right, it must also be impermanent. Yeah, it's a produced phenomenon. So this idea here of looking at the mind being impermanent and empty, that's the big saving thing. Because, you know, like everything, without a mind, we can't, you know, we can't talk about anything, can we? But once you've got a mind, then everything starts to take place. But whatever is taking place is impermanent. It's just our ideas about things that sort of freezes things up, and the way our senses approach the physical world, right? Everything does seem not depend upon our senses and solid and stable. In fact, it's the complete opposite. So here's some things I put down about this. So how can we use our understanding of impermanence to overcome hatred? So what you do here is you take there's always three parts to this, right? There's yourself as a subject, there's the object, and there's the activity. They're all impermanent, each of them. You just take yourself, you're impermanent. The object that I'm upset about, it's impermanent. And the thought that I have is this anger, disgust, hatred, it's impermanent too. And that's how a simple way of using impermanence is to do that. None of it has remained the same the thought of it. The moment I became angry, everything after that has changed. But yeah, like I said, now the other thing, of course, impermanence also opposes the opposite of hatred, which is the attachment. Any disturbing emotion, you know, like when you look at the Pali tradition, this was their major thing. Just always impermanence. Buddha taught first in the Buddha taught, last in the talk. This is to stop us clinging to that phenomenon. And you know, like if you look at how, like everything around us is impermanent, isn't it? Everything, like in this room, it's all impermanent. Everything is a product in this room. That's all impermanent. Like when we put our senses upon it, certainly doesn't look like it. Everything seems to be permanent, stable. It looks like it's not changing.
Except the twinkling lights.
Yes. But the light's still there. That's right. The twinkle goes. Yeah, yeah. That's right. So again, it's the same thing, that how you use impermanence. You just look at yourself, the object, the mental factor, the mind of attachment. It changes. We change, objects change. So we can meditate on impermanence. So with this idea of, you know, the stabilizing meditation we talked about, the mind, the calmer mind, the resting mind, so that suppresses the grasping at permanence. But impermanence is the antidote to permanence, in other words. Like, so you look around, how's everything appearing to us? Permanently. We have to recollect impermanence. So when we remember it, it stops us grasping at the permanence of the phenomena or pushing it away. Analysis undermines the grasping of permanence. So again, these two work, you know, they can work on one side, you can do it like that, or else you can do the other side. So in other words, the saying is I place my mind on my understanding of impermanence. That is to overcome the grasping of permanence. My analysis of this object has revealed to me its impermanent state. That's why I'm not going to grasp it to be permanent. So these two can work separately, but you can bring them together. And you bring them together, of course, to engage in what is useful in this life. So we stop grasping at permanence and use our understanding of impermanence to create a good, meaningful life for ourselves. Analytical meditation investigates impermanence. Stabilizing meditation rests in the resulting insight. The experience, one reflects on change, this is the analysis, then abides in the direct feeling of transience, the stabilization. Insight, conviction derived from analysis becomes direct, non-conceptual perception through the stabilization, and this integrated practice turns a philosophical understanding into a stable, lived wisdom that reduces the grasping. Now, some of my partner, she's got this, you know, she's been teaching in the university, she's had a good education and all these sort of things. But one of the things I've noticed is that there seems to be maybe inability is too harsh on it, I don't know, but they don't use what they understand.
Yeah.
I find that really shocking philosophically when you
there's a disconnect.
Yeah, there's a disconnect between the learning and then what you do with the learning. Like, say, we're all learning here about impermanence, right? Suppose it's all learning, but still behaves as if things are permanent.
But that's because they teach that.
Yeah.
They don't practice
it. No, that's right. That's the thing.
They don't apply it.
No.
In life.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I thought, yeah, when you get these great pieces of wisdom, you pick up all over the world, can't you? Like, yeah, there's some of them really strong, you go, that's right. And then you do it, isn't it? Just the way you are now. It's not just a piece of information you pick up and you stay the same.
But it's just like doctors still drink too much alcohol.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, just
they
like that.
They obviously know that it's not good.
Yeah, but they stay the same way, but they still keep doing it.
Yeah,
but you're quite right. No doubt I'm the same too, but in other ways, I sort of see the wisdom. I go, that's great, grab it. That's mine, I'm using it. I agree, you know.
But I think also that with a lot of academics, even though they have a lot of knowledge about their subjects and can teach it, they often don't reflect on other parts of life. I mean, certainly the more science people that I deal with or have dealt with don't have common sense. You know, they actually don't reflect and think about how this is going to work in the real world.
Okay. I'll start raving. I've got a good little story, but it's not right. We're just not coming to the end. Teach something that's honest and factual and so forth, and yet your own behavior is the opposite of it. I've been like that for years. But it's like that. But I'm really shocked when you get great pieces of advice and you don't go, shit, that's usable. Yeah, that's what I can, that's, you know. You didn't know it, now you know it. Like, that can help me a great deal, and you don't.
But I think also a lot of us who are here are practicing Buddhism because we choose to.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is that I think we want to be better at what we do.
Oh, we do.
And so when you hear something, that's, I'm going to reflect on that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good way for me to approach life.
Yeah, yeah. That's
a good way for me to think.
Yeah.
But that's our interest.
Yeah, I know.
That's our interest to do that.
Right, and not be the interest of others, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're quite right. That's right. Yeah, a bit like that. So let me see just the final part of our teaching, this idea of, so we've meditated and now our meditation has come to an end. So what do we do with what we've just done? We actually dedicate it. What are we dedicating? The energy, the virtue that we've created in this meditation. Why? So it doesn't become lost. It becomes inexhaustible. It becomes inexhaustible because we dedicate it to Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. The aim, of course, is supreme enlightenment. Who for? Everyone. How? We unite method and wisdom. The bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness. And so these are these major parts of the dedication of five or six there. Okay, let that go. We're up to 8:30, I know that. We'll do our first final meditation. Maybe just get comfortable and let your body breathe itself. And let your awareness settle on that natural rhythm of your breath. And then set an altruistic intention to see reality as a flowing process, not as a fixed thing. You do this by looking at subtle impermanence, the moment by moment change in everything. This shows that the stability we see is only an illusion. It's like a snapshot of a moving river. Seeing this is the first step in loosening the grasping that causes suffering. So our reality is like a sky of clouds, solid from far away, but up close, always shifting and dissolving. So why does the insight into change and impermanence free us from difficult emotions? Those emotions and the situation and even the self and feeling it are all like passing clouds in awareness. So when anger arises, how might you apply this understanding? Perhaps you could try to see anger as being like a storm cloud. It's dark, black, intense, and temporary. Its nature is to change and pass. So what happens to our need to control everything when we see this clearly? Well, we soften. We find we can't hold on to anything. Then we watch it move through. Listen for a few moments, rest as if you were the open sky, and let all clouds arise and pass without struggle. And exhale, let your eyes flutter open. Come to the end of our class. So our takeaway tonight is this, we also know what meditation is. It's becoming familiar with mental states and cultivating them. We know what the purposes are. We know some of the motivations and types. And so perhaps between now and next year, If you can, if things get difficult, do breathing meditation. You don't need to analyze, right? Most of us think too much anyway. So just come back to the breath and slow down. If you can, if you want to, so meditate on the Buddha. Remember again, meditate means to like cultivate your awareness of Buddha. And of course, this depends upon your understanding what Buddha is. And lastly, try to identify a fault or two that you might have and see what's the antidote to it. What can I do about it? And then perhaps over Christmas, just doing some work. Thinking that's the one, become familiar with it. What an antidote. Okay, so let's do it. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into their enlightened state. May the supreme dual body teacher not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. As long as space remains, as long as thinking beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sufferings of the world. And then prayer for as long, for as holiness as long that. A wish granted, wish fulfilling joy, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind, tending yet far, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, a prayer for the finding of Rinpoche's reincarnation, and maybe the correct one that happened quickly. In holding and spreading the Moon's precious and complete teachings through exploration and practice, you wore the armor of patience that has never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, I make this request.